Hello, I'm Emily Nelson. We are at the Ginseng Board of Wisconsin office in Marathon. I am here on October 12, 2013, and could I please get you to state your name and spell your name?
My name is Abraham, so my last name is Vang, V-A-N-G.
Well, thank you so much for coming with us and being with us today. I guess my first question would be, how long have you been in ginseng farming?
About since the 1990s, so almost 23 years.
And so I know we spoke earlier about this, but so you have been in farming since childhood. Could you talk a little bit about how your childhood in farming went?
Oh, regarding the family?
Yes.
So usually the family who ate like older 13 to 15, they can help him wheat, you know, put the wheat on the field. The weekend, if they don't have something to do, you know, that all the Hmong children, what we parents, we try to recruit them, let them help the parent work on the farm or in the home. So usually some will be some age 13 to 15, you know. What our children will be encouraged them to help parent in a farm.
And did this take place in Wisconsin?
Yes, in Wisconsin.
In what portion of Wisconsin?
Well, I think just the kid, it would be usually we don't let them do other, like a machinery, they have not been trained to operate. Also, any other danger, they do not know. So we let them do some other safety, that's all, you know.
So when you were a child, what was your experience in farming?
Well, just my child, when I was a little boy, so I helped my father. My father, he is a horse farmer. So he sold his animal. And so when I ate like a 12 years, I started helping my father, you know, work on the farm, help him look at the animal, and ride some hole around, make a farm around the house, his farm. What most the key when I grow up, and that I helped my father. Then after, it's 1962, you know, and I grew up about 14 years old. I have been a recruit, serve for American, CIA, help American recruit American pilot who shot down during the Vietnam and Chinese border. Secondly, we help American protecting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So North Vietnamese will use the Ho Chi Minh Trail, deliver the supply, the military, order go to Saigon, South Vietnam. So that I mostly what I done after 1960 is the war in is a heavy fight day and night. Mostly we had to escape village to village, town to town. So we don't have time. Good farmer, you know. So just all our parents who really like to become the farmer, so they had to escape play to play. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that my experience, what I have been done.
And just to clarify, was this in Vietnam or was this in Laos or Cambodia?
Yeah, between the Vietnam, between North Vietnamese, Cambodia, Laos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, the type of farming when you were a child, what did you grow?
Mostly, my parents, they grow such like corn, rye, mostly what they grow, you know. Usually, it's my Hmong people, we in Laos, so our government, they don't have the assistance like the United States. So, every farmer, every family who have to work hard, produce. Make sure they have some food for the children. And So we don't have any program like the United States assistance help from the Department of Social Service. So every family, they have to depend their own in the farm, you know. And that most among people, they don't wait for government to help them. So they can do it by themselves, you know. According to the insane old parent, they say, well, if you let someone help you, like they will shy, you know, they will shy. They say, well, I the same human being. How let other day, like I go, man, you know, you can help me, this, who can help me that. They don't like. They say, well, we love faith. So we have to do our own, you know. So most among people, what they carry, you know.
Yeah. Could you tell me about your family? How many children were in it?
I had 7 children, 2 daughters, 5 sons. So all they live in Wisconsin. My daughter, 2 daughters, they marry and they live in Warsaw. Yeah.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have about 5 sisters, 3 brothers. My other 5 sisters, they're in the United States. But my older brother, he had been killed during the war. And so I have another brother who lived down in Oklahoma.
And so going back to during the war before you came to America, what was difficult about farming while all of this was going on, besides just having to move from town to town?
Yeah. Yes, usually, like I mentioned earlier, so we live in Laos, so we just do ourselves, agriculture, farming, helping our family. So the early in 1970, we came to United States. We tried to do what we had done in our homeland. But it won't work. It won't work. Reason first will be the farm, the land. We don't have the land available. Secondly, it's farm machinery or farm equipment. So we now have everything. So we have the empty hand. So we cannot afford for that kind, you know. So what our living together, we each the city is the village depending how many family, so we can let all the head leader, you know, head of the family, all we come together, you know. We can plan and how we will be living from today to the future. Or we have any other thing we can do, because the one we had experience in Laos, not only farmer and fight during the war, so we don't have any job skill, we don't have the language. So we need first language, second would be job skill, so we can fill our own application, unemployment application, or we can look for job. Then we can make a living in the United States, you know. We had the plan, we had the idea, oh, we had to go back our what we had done in Laos, but like we had some travel, land, machinery. So we cannot afford. And so we had to become some, they are younger, they go to school, they complete their high school degree, they go to college, they got the some lawyer, some doctor degree from the Hmong community, mostly we stand for. Mostly people, they larger percent, they employment, they work for the factory, and a very small number, they do their own grocery store, or some they can grow some vegetable and sell for the farm market during the summer, you know. That's among every community, what you go, St. Paul, Minnesota, like a larger Hmong population in Warsaw, Milwaukee. So you go down the capital, right? You can see a lot of Hmong farmers who send the vegetable around on the front door. And anyway, at the farm market, you can see all the more people. Mm-hmm. They really like to become farmer, and they can self-sufficiency from the farmer. But like everything costs too much money, so we can do it. So that mostly more what we do today, you know.
So when did you leave Laos to come to America?
I left Laos in 1975. After November, Saigon is filled for Vietnam completely, and Laos, Cambodia is the field for the Communist Party Lao, Communist Vietnam. They control all the country, and they look for the one woman or man military who served for American, and catch them and send to the re-education camp. But re-education camp, they can, when you in the camp, you become the treat you like a prisoner. So you work hard and no food, very little food, like a prisoner, you know. And very lot of people have been suffering, and like a high range official who have been killed all and during the camp, you know. So we are very lucky with the one live nearby the Thai border, so we can escape from the Laos, cross the Mekong River, and to the Thailand, and become the refugee, a refugee camp in Thailand. Then later on, several years in United Nations, they had a program to accept a refugee, you know, and from the camp, go to other country, like come to United States, France, Australia, Canada, or other small country, you know. That the Hmong people, we not immigrant, we the refugee. So we came here and we have been served for American CIA during the war. So like you see Cambodia, or had the Cambodia, had the Vietnamese, they came from the same with us. But if we're different, Korea, you know, Japan, Chinese, and other, because they're seeking economy. But us would be political, you know, refugee, you know. So that you see Hmong would be part of the, President Bush, he said, Hmong part of the American partner, you know. We will be work together and helping our community grow, you know, and better life, better future. So that we plan very, very hard. But like I mentioned you earlier, some Hmong complete the doctor degree, but we have a very small number, you know. Mm-hmm. And according to the Hmong population we live in the United States today, we might be over 350,000 around in U.S. But mostly our calculate our number is the high education. We might have more than 8,000 to 9,000. But the who got a doctor degree, we might have about 15,000 or 2,000 yet, compared with a small number, you know. So that the Hmong community, everywhere you see, they work hard. They try to build the future in here because we consider here our homeland. So we have to work hard wherever we can, you know. Mm-hmm. We can help our family first, second, we can help our community so we can build a future and build a life for our community and our children for the next generation. What we try to, we try to prepare our vision, you know, lay up our vision for our Hmong future. So today we work very hard. We call all the Hmong United States come together. We can find a solution how we can help each other, and that we do today.
And so talking about when you first arrived in America, how did you go about settling in?
Well, very, very difficult, you know, when I came to Laos to, I left Laos, it's May 28, 1975. When I left Laos, when I that long, I came to Thailand. I stayed for Thailand for, I think, about 6-7 months. Then I came from refugee camp, Thailand, in 1976. October 1st, when my first hometown arrived, is Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah. And we came, it's a Catholic diocese, who's the physical agency who receive more refugees, like not only Hmong, but we have more than 5,000 refugees for diocese, for Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Hmong. So we live together. And we do not know nothing. The language, it's everything. It's like a like we don't see in the future, you know, because very, very hard, because you do not know language. We have your own plan, but you're thinking it will not work because you don't know the language. That's, we had to go to school, learn the language. Like myself, I came just only 10 days. Then my sponsor asking me to go to work, you know. I said, well, I still need the language because I could not communicate with my coworker. I could not communicate with my supervisor, or how should they tell me, should I understand what they mean? They said, well, you can go to work and you go to school after work, you know. So, in 10 days, I go to work. We're with the company who put the carpet, you know, and so I work at daytime, then evening I can go to school. So during I work struggle during for the first 3 years, I had to wake up early, 6 o'clock I had to stay by the bus stop, so I had to transfer 3 times from the bus and go to my workplace, you know. So after get off work, I had to do same thing. And so I came from the work direct to the school. And the school supposed to be start 6 o'clock. So I had to be the school by 6 o'clock. Then after 9:30, 10 o'clock, because the school is a little too far from the city area, you know. And it's late, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, the bus, only one bus. You can travel, you can wait in maybe hour, you know, then the bus will come. Then when I catch a bus, get home around 12, midnight, you know, then shower, take shower, then go to the bank. Then the next morning, I had to wake up early to 6 o'clock, same thing. So I had to do that for 3 years. Then after 3 years, I go take a driver license. So I got my driver. Then I bought my own car, you know. That would be easy for me. So I can go anywhere what I can go, you know. That it helped my family a lot because every family, we want to do shopping. We want to go any place. Yeah, so that what I have been done. It's very, very difficult when we come to the United States and the our first group, because we don't know the language, and you had to very dedicate yourself and you had to work hard. So that I took about 5 years. So I got my GED. I take about 3 times to pay my GED diploma. So when I can, I test essay the other high school. They say you will be the grade 10, you know, and put me in the grade 10. So take me 5 years, 3 times take. So I got my GED. Then I will be go vocational school. I take and go vocational school about 18 months. I graduation for my machine shop program. Then I start a little better job. So during that time, when I came for 1976-75, it's $2.10 per hour, you know. But after I graduation, so for my machine shop program, I got paid around close $5 per hour. Then after I got full-time job, then I go part-time again for my electric, you know. So I take about, usually program take 24 months to complete the electric repair, small machine repair, you know. But took me about more than 3 years, you know. So I will be complete my electric repair degree. So after that, I got a good job in the change $5 to $8 per hour. So what I see, big change, big different. So during that time, I still have only 3 kids, you know. When we came from Laos, I have 1 child. And we live in Thailand. We had a daughter. She born the refugee camp. So the other 7, I have, I'm born in the United States, you know. So we work very, very hard, and we had the future. We thought in the United States, they succeeded from the one you had high education. As you, if you had good education, good degree, you had knowledge, you had a skill, you got what you want, you know. If you don't have any education, so you it's hard to make it. You have to stay on the, it's just a life skill, you know. And so that we try to encourage our children and our community, our relatives, say, oh, you kid, you have to start from the right direction, you know. And you don't start from the right direction, and when you got older, like we came from Laos, I age 32. So today I 67. Yeah, 67. And most 30 years ago, we still like a young man. But now we become, I told my kid 30 years ago, I like a young man, but now I'm a great grandfather, you know. Yeah, I had the 12 great-grandchildren.
And how old is your oldest grandchild, and how old is your youngest?
My younger is, he's 20 for this year. My older, he's closer 40. Yeah.
And so you talked about getting your degree in mechanical engineering, or
electrical repair, you know.
Electrical repair.
Right.
And so how did you get into farming? How did you make that
jump? So, yeah, but in 1983, you know, at president, it's a Carter, he came to U.S. president, so some company had been filled, you know. Our company, we have more than 800 employees. So we had laid off more than 300. I would be the third time laid off. Then I, that time my aunt and my uncle, they live in Warsaw. Yeah, they came here in 1978, and they live in Warsaw. And also I have more of my relatives and family, mostly the larger number in Twin City, you know. Some small number in California. Then I came visit them. Then here they, I heard about, they talk about ginseng, you know, and go vote for American or Anglo friend farmer. I said, what is your ginseng? They say, put the week. Well, I can, that time it's still like in the June, you know, the summer month. Then I go with my uncle and I look at the ginseng field, you know, and by covered by the woodshed, and also we went to talk to other growers, say how much money you invest money for, you know, example like 1 acre. So he told up the section, it cost about $13 per section. That 13 still very cheap that time, you know. Yeah. And the seed, it will be between 80, 90, you know, or 100 per pound. So, well, just that I go back in my work in Tennessee. Then I decided to move to I love and lay off the job. Then I decided to move to Warsaw. That's in 1984, you know. So when I came to Warsaw, so I worked for, it will be voluntarily, and work for the Southern Baptist Convention, you know. So helping our, it's the congregation and the church group. So then after 2 years, 4 years, and I got my job, and it's for the agency, like I told, the agency we provide, deliver service to Southeast Asia refugee, you know, and funding from the OOR and from the state. So we find a job, find some employment, try to provide some interpreter, translation for all the refugee, including Laos and Vietnamese, who came to our agency asking for help, you know. So I worked for there for most about 18 years. Then I retired, you know. And my other involvement, so I still volunteer, help the community make a fundraiser, American Red Cross, some United Way, and also my other experience, what I have and I participate for Wisconsin rural leadership. You probably heard about that program, you know, for 2 year program. So I the night group, so that I still participate for my alumni, and helping my team work together, and go county to county, provide our education assistance. Which they have meet each other and help other group and help our community, you know, make a broad picture and helping them. And so if they need, like myself, I have been working for the Hmong community or Laotian or Vietnamese, and helping them prepare for, like we talk about plan for the future, how we will be succeed in the United States, how we can build a better life in here, how we can helping our government, helping our community. So we had to find a good direction, you know, and we had to follow through that we will succeed. If we don't have a good plan, for we don't lay up a good vision for the future, so we might not succeed. What I try to educate, help my community, you know. So I retired, but I still run back and forth, you know, help my people.
And so, going back to when you first learned about ginseng farming, how did you, was that also trying to secure for your future when you decided to get in?
Yeah, I thinking, and I thought I would be quitting because I, yeah, the market, it like last 4 or 5 years ago at the market, you know, it's the market filled out like most about the decade, you know. So mostly we had our own equipment, we had our own machinery, we already purchased bumbao. So we employment had been, economy had been slowly, so we thinking we will be drop off the farmer, but we could not, if we drop off, we will not make a living, you know. So that we still have many debt to pay, many other stuff to pay. So myself and I encourage all my Hmong friend, mostly they is the part-time for the ginseng farmer. They all the full-time on the job, and they spend only part-time for the weekend for the ginseng farmer. But we still do some very small number. Some family, they have maybe a couple acres. Maybe they keep growing every year, maybe some up then at 3 or 4 acres. So like my family, we have rock about, we stock about 3 or 4 acres per year, you know. And so in the past, but today and for the next, be thinking it will be cut down because I get older, and also just probably get to my children, you know. They will be continue for this they found me, they like it. So I think myself, I will not and do no more because it's that's good enough, you know. But I will help my children and help my family, my friend, my neighbor, who will be continue. So I still be around and support what they want, you know.
So where is your farm located?
My farm located up in Lincoln County, and it's north of Merrill, you know, right.
And how large is your farm?
The farm will be, if you just lease, you know, we just leave from other farmer, the land. So usually it's 6-7 years ago, some land available is you lease some small acres, you know. But now today it's hard to find the land because most economy like a crop stronger like corn, soybean, you know, at the market stronger. Most the farm owner, they don't want to leave a couple acres for you, you know. So mostly we very hard to find the land. So we had to go way far from the city, like upper Merrill or upper Indigo, you know, far from the city. There's someone, they made a small patch, like a small acre, 3 or 4 acres, they won't lease, you know.
Can you talk about the process of when you get the land, about how you get it prepared to grow ginseng, and then the process of growing ginseng?
Okay, the process to plant the land, so we got the land, and so the contract be done. Then we first we have to apply the Roundup, you know. We kill it. I kill the grass, kill the weed for maybe about a month. Then we start to prepare, plant the land. Then we prepare the land, and so we had to took the soil sample and to the at the for lab. So we had to know about fertilizer program and light program, how much we need, you know. So it's completely test, so they send that tech come over. So we tend it to go to the our feed mill, you know, and they can help us calculate to see how what you need. So they completely add together. So that we put the fertilizer first. And before we make a batch maker, you know. So that's what we prepare the land. We had to apply some pesticide. And so pesticide, like mostly the slug and nail, like whiteworm, cutworm, many other, you know, that we had to apply before we put the seed up.
And so when you're harvesting ginseng, could you talk about how you do it? Is it a family
process? Yeah, the family. Usually, we thinking the most of Hmong family. They usually overseas in Laos. Most of Hmong people they use like because like a natural like they consider for oak, you know. Natural earth they get from the wood for the mountain. But ginseng, we just heard in the United States, you know, say our Chinese friend, they have been used for more than 3 to 4 thousand years. So that we try to use the ginseng, our Chinese friend, to teach us what we can use, you know. So more family, yes, we use some ginseng for food, for tea, whatever we want, you know. So that family we talk about, and ginseng will be the number one for our family. Some they use for put some like a malahide, you know. They put some other liquid, whiskey together, and then they just drink a little during the dinner, you know. So that most people they like. In the future, from now for in the future, we don't know because most it's the land cost too high. If you don't have your own land, it's hard to find the land for lease. Secondly, if the fuel go up and chemical go up, so if the market down, we don't know yet how many people they will be afford. But I think the Hmong community, I hope, will be stand with small number is still continue today, you know.
And so your children, you said that they were continuing on in the tradition. Can you talk about their interest?
Yeah, most my oldest two sons, they very interesting. And my young boy, what I talk about 20-year-old, so he took the Chinese language, UWMC, and he say he will teach the Chinese language, and he will keep continue to help his brother and grow ginseng. So future they can go to China and do their own business around like the Singapore or it's the mainland. What they plan to do, you know, it's the market key stronger, and so that my son and they thought they will continue, you know.
You spoke earlier when you first learned about ginseng that you spoke to other growers about ginseng and the process of it. Could you talk a little bit more about how other ginseng farmers have helped you?
Yeah, usually we, like if we close neighbor, you know, we can change, like a labor change, you know. So some I had machinery they don't have, I can do for them and they can help me other. So usually the hard work, we need more, we need the teamwork, like a straw shredder, you know. When you spray a shredder, your straw, you have to have three or four people. So another three men had to be the wagon, you know, push straw into the for the machine, and one man had to drive the tractor. So that would be, we need a teamwork. So we had to etching, and you help me, then I help you other. So mostly during the small thing, what they can help, and they can make a labor etching. Mostly like the emergency, like we harvesting, you know, they have a nice stick will pee, they will have more root pick, so they had to hire, you know, hire additional people helping.
And where do you find the additional people to help? Are they just your neighbors? Do you do you hire any teenage?
Yeah, we hire some people. They during the on this the harvest season, you know, a lot of people. Some in the Hmong community, they have some people who from other town, like from Twin City, from other town, from Wisconsin, coming in Warsaw, looking for a temporary job, you know, for the farm. So that we, they come in, they keep calling, hey, you have something to do. So we look for work, you know, and we can, they come in. Mostly our family, like I say, we have the children, they helping each other. So usually we have a few people, not much, you know, right. Most of the Hmong family are, they help their own family. So mostly they don't hire much people, you know, right.
And so talking about your family and your culture, what are some traditions that you have?
The traditional culture, what Hmong we have the shaman. Hmong believed and sent for Hmong carry for more than 6,000 years, you know, what we... and send the respect and they they work for, you know. So we mostly we call it the Hmong traditional were different other nation. Some like a Buddha, some like a many other like a Middle East, you know, and their religion, you know. We from Asia, but we usually Lao, Thai, Cambodia, they and they the Buddha, but we not. Some, yeah, we go too. We enjoy together, you know. Some we go with them. We can enjoy together. Like we got help Hmong and our family. We respect our old parent, you know, who just passed away. And so when they pass away, and usually you see the Hmong funeral. I don't know. It's sometimes maybe you might be stopped, and you can to see what they do different. The Hmong traditional, they believe you respect your parent. So like you respect God, and when your parent they got the good news from you because you treat them well. So when they pass away, they are all they have, you know, and they will leave to you. And so when the parent pass away and the children, they had to find the good cemetery, you know. And the good cemetery, you know, for Hmong, it's about the traditional belief for many thousand years. If you put your parent in the right spot, the right place, but they say dragon, you know, you put in the dragon position, and the dragon head or dragon play when dragon live, the some dragon won't be raised your parent. They raise it up, and they up they will be raise their children. So you leave behind, you will be easy, you will become a state official, city official, or you can be the rich family. You can live in the healthy family. You can become the leader of the future, what the Hmong believes, you know. So that the Hmong, mostly that is traditional for we talk about for the funeral. But the respect for daily Hmong life, what we call hupli. Hupli is actually so-called, you know. So-called, maybe your spirit. Maybe you see some, you went to the farm or you go someplace else. You must get something, you know. Maybe we say maybe you are spiritual. It might be scared, you know. And maybe they will make you be sick or maybe you become other bad dream. So that mostly become you are having sick. So usually Hmong, what they do, many different. The traditional Hmong had the many, many things to believe, including the when the lady, she pregnant in her stomach, she pregnant, not allow her to go far. So not allow her to walk across the river, and not allow her to go to the jungle, to the wood. So when the baby been born, it's a Hmong, they use the pot where you're cooking, and the black one, you put a little black, put in the head before you took the baby out, you know, go outside. So that the Hmong believe would be the beginning, including traditional in the home, mostly they be the shaman, you know. Shaman will be the first Hmong respect. First will be shaman, second will be herbal. And the shaman, it was story. They talk about the story. It's a long story and before Christ coming, you know. And they call the Shiji. Shiji is the first man. When he lives in this earth, he can raise the people up from the dead. And after that, devil, you know, devil who came to Shiji and asking him, you can go shaman, treat my son, you know, and when the Shiji went up to the heaven. And he forgot to put all his family lock it together. Then he just go to heaven, and the devil came to his house, you know, came to earth and took his first son, and to change for like animal for he to shaman. The Hmong shaman they use for animal go to sacrifice your spiritual, your soul, you know. And the animal, what they use for sacrifice, just only for 12 months. The shaman say to the animal, you had to be here for 12 months. I give you food, give you shelter, everything. I will not let you stay here forever. But I let you here stay 12 months. Then another will be take your place, then you can go, you know. But the shaman, what they use to the animal. And most that the monk believe, and the shaman, he's the first man, he came to this earth, and when he dwell in this earth, he can treat people from the dead, what they talk about, you know. And that's the monk believing, and so we use the shaman until today, and you go to the monk family, you say, oh, you shaman? They say, yeah, you can see little shell they make in the wall, you know. And they hand on drum, that all the equipment hang together. But that is it's a good thing what they believe in. The son, daughter who become ill, become sick, the shaman, they had to go find out to see what's wrong. It could be some devil involving or some other stuff, so they can do it, you know. So that's the monk believing, or traditional, and the first to be done in the family when you're ill and you're sick. And the secondly will be herbal medication after, you know.
So the monk retained these traditions when they came to America? They kept them?
You mean the...
So the traditions that they had in Laos and in Vietnam, when they came to America, they kept many of them?
Yeah, yes. So it's still a lot of monks still, it's still shaman, yeah, in the community. Mostly have, and they go to the Christianity, but they have up then still shaman, because they believe that the old traditional, what the parent, great-grandparent, they have been caring for so many thousand years, so that they try to respect and they proceed, you know. So mostly today is, I know the monk in Warsaw they're still shaman.
Have your traditions changed any since you came to America and has been in this community in Warsaw?
Yeah, they do.
In what ways?
You mean the...
Just traditions your family do on holidays or...
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we do that too. So mostly the holiday back to our homeland, we don't have that one, you know. But usually the holiday, monk holiday, we just had like remember our New Year. First of all, the most important holiday that monk prepare for is a New Year, you know. Just we don't have the Christmas, we don't have the Easter, we don't have the thank you giving, and so we just have only New Year. Some we had the birthday, you know, birthday for parents, for children. We recognize that, you know, but mostly most parents they forgot, they don't do it. Mostly in overseas when we live in Laos, Thailand, usually they don't care much about the birthday, you know, for their children. But we came to the new land, new country, we never forgot it. Yeah. We had to do some for our children, you know.
Speaking about language, what language do you primarily speak at home?
I speak usually Hmong. Yeah, if you speak at home. I know 7 different languages. I spoke Laotian, Thailand, Vietnam, Japanese, and some little Chinese, you know.
How has that helped you in your jobs in America?
Well, it's very helpful, my job, you know. So the most important, I use the language in English in my job, in the United States. So when during the war, what I mentioned early, so I work for American. It's the officer who came to Laos. So I work for them, but we don't have much time to go to school. We just learn like a night time, teaching by our American friend or teaching by some teacher, and generally maybe three times per week. So that mostly the language what we use in the workplace today is English.
So speaking about traditional food, what foods do you cook at home?
Usually the food we prepare what we like it, you know. Yeah, we had a lot of different kinds to see. Mostly the Hmong, we like vegetable with chicken, pork, beef. We can cook like with the vegetable, with many other meat together. So yeah, we prepare it's our own food. Most of the kids, they like the pizza, they like some hamburger, they like other, you know. But mostly the parents, they prefer is their own food, you know. But what we prepare and we eat every day, you know.
Do you grow the food that
yeah,
you eat?
Yeah, it's a vegetable we grow ourselves in our farm. And also other stuff like someone do they had the land, they raise their own animal, like a chicken, pea, some if you cow, they can butch for during the winter, or they can near what they want. But mostly we do our own garden, you know.
What do you grow in your garden?
The garden, we grow some mostly soybean, bean, tomato, potato, some many other like carrot, cucumber. We grow some many 5, 6, 7 different kinds, you know. Sweet corn, we use most the sweet corn, you know. There's some Hmong, they use some try to grow some rice, what we grow in Laos, but it Wisconsin is the climate and the weather quite different the south, you know. We try to grow in by our own seed, like sweet corn in Laos, and rice in Laos we plant in Wisconsin. Very tall, very nice, about 2 inches tall from American corn, but it never produce any grain, you know, no grain. And that I think Wisconsin is the rich soil, too much soil, you know, yeah.
Wisconsin, I know, has a lot of Hmong communities, and you mentioned in Minneapolis, but do you know of any of the other Hmong communities in Wisconsin?
Yes, I know around, I know the larger population in the United States, it will be the first will be California, the second will be Twin Cities, third will be Wisconsin. The Wisconsin, we have 18 different cities, what is Hmong live today. So we had the larger population, like Warsaw, we had the second largest people, there's 7,000 people in Warsaw today. So we had like Milwaukee would be the first one, and Warsaw second, the Madison, Alberton, Green Bay, Oshkosh, Manitoba, La Crosse, Eau Claire, Menominee. So far, what I know, they like Watertown and Jamesville, you know. Most of them, they live in this city in Wisconsin, but like a Twin City, not much small. They live in larger population, just only Twin City, you know, but only Minneapolis and St. Paul, what they live. The small other town, they might be small family, they live, you know, like a Rochester. Not much, about 10, 15 family more down Rochester. So I include like Iowa, we don't have much more down the state. Maybe could be 10, 15 family. At the larger, another whole population today is like Arkansas, you know. Arkansas, it will be Missouri. It's Oklahoma. That's a large population. And it will be another large population in North Carolina. So most of they live, you know. Tennessee, not much. We have some, but not much. But yes.
Concerning the seasons in Wisconsin, I know we get really cold weather. How does that affect your farming seasons, and how do seasons change your practices?
Well, I think most kids they like the snow, you know. They like snow. They like make a snowman. They still go and make a snowman, but the older, you know, like the elder person, like they say call to them. They now similar go out, you know, during the snow season, cold, windy, and it's like very, very cold outside. Usually they don't like much the cold weather, and because in Laos we don't have much cold weather and no snow. Some, like December, you might upper northern Laos as a mountain, you can see some freezing some morning, you know, ice in the morning, but you never see snow wake up like the United States, you know. So, the weather here is the beginning, like we can hear a lot of people, they say, oh, too much snow. We had to move to the, like the southern or on the west coast. But they live that today, that's okay, you know. Everybody say, okay, don't mind. My friend who live in down Florida, he say we had no Christmas here at all. He said, what, there's no Christmas because no snow, he said. Yeah.
And so would you say that you're a lot busier in the summertime and in the fall when you have to harvest than you are in the winter?
Yeah, I like it. The harvest we have better, we have to prepare for before snow, you know. And that we like the better. I like cold weather, you know. Yeah, I like snow, you know. When I younger, I like fishing, but I like skier, you know. I had a snowmobile, and so we can go up north like a Tomahawk Rylander, ride a snowmobile. I like it, you know. Yeah.
So, talking about the Ginseng Board of Wisconsin, how have they helped you in your farming?
Yeah, Ginseng Board of Wisconsin, they like the umbrella. They oversee all the ginseng farmers. They provide a lot of technical assistance. They provide a lot of is a grower. They're helping educate, set it up for the field trip. It's the education and the research for all the Wisconsin grower, ginseng grower. I see that the resource very useful, and the assistance provide for every grower, I think, very excellent, you know, because we are, and they, secondly, they help find the market, the research for the market, and they make several trips each year to oversee for trade show and meet with our Chinese buyer and a larger company oversee. So I see the ginseng board is done successfully. Great job, you know.
So over the years, talking about the market, you said that it's gotten harder to buy land. How has it been selling ginseng?
The land, you mean the buy land, right?
Yeah, so growing ginseng and selling ginseng.
Okay.
How has it changed over the years?
All right, okay. Well, I think there will be mostly during the harvest season, and the buyer they come from overseas, And they're coming, they know it's the harvest season, they're coming. And so when we, after we get done harvesting, we our crop prepare it ready and dry, bring the washer and dryer. And so the buyer, they can come and look at, you know, and look at your root, you can your crop. They say it, they cut root, it will be the market what looking for. They maybe offer you a price, you know. So they give you opportunity for you, what you're asking for. And so we don't have much problem for sale, you know, depending in if you're asking the right price and you sell the right what you ask, that's good. But sometimes you got the good root. I told my mom grower, they got the good root, but they sell the wrong price, you know. Say they don't make what they want, you know. So that's the most important. So we don't have any problem depending on the owner, you know.
So how do you try to get a good price for ginseng?
Well, the price, so we know mostly from our ginseng board, and they market research, so they know what is in the market overseas is go on and changing. So secondly, we know what from the overseas market, you know, like from the to see what economy overseas, and we know what is like we have and ginseng board have been twice a year overseas, so they know what is the market gone, you know. So that we go by like the price what we know what we're asking for, you know. Some market it demand and our market like this year will be a little stronger for the last couple years.
So how is selling ginseng different than selling at the farmer's market?
Well, it because the farmer market, I went to San Francisco and New York and in Chinatown, you know. And so I thinking if the ginseng is you can sell like the farm market, but had to be the location look like Chinatown, you know. And mostly it we say about the Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam, or Hmong, Laos, and other, they do not similar use ginseng like Chinese, you know. If you go to open the farm market like a Chinatown, I think there will be it's good, you know, good, but very hard to open the farm market down in Chinatown because they have a lot of competition with the retail store in Chinatown. They have the buyer, they have their own contract with each retail store, you know. And it's good. You can have your own shop available, you can have your own room and you can sell. That's real good. But it had to be like a Chinatown. I think it would be better place, you know.
And so there's a wider audience for other crops, do you think?
Yeah. So mostly I see today if the ginseng root go to the Asia store, any Asia store, like from Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, Hmong, so they had all the American ginseng is there for sale, but not much like mostly we see some other buyer who they produce some little packet, you know, for tea, for gun, for many other like a cookie, so many other small stuff, and they sell for the Oriental food store. You can see some today, you know. But mostly, if we can sell ginseng like a vegetable farmer, it's because our customers are generally our Chinese friend, you know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to sell, you know.
Do you use ginseng in your house?
Yeah, I do.
In what ways do you primarily use it?
You mean the ginseng we use?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be, I feel that very good one, because my wife, she had the diabetes too, and she takes the doctor medication, and she takes some ginseng. It's for her blood sugar, and I think will be she get the normal, and later on she go to see her doctor, say her is a diabetes will be stable, but she say, well, let me get doctor a pill for if you weak, and let me just take some ginseng to see how different, but she Tayshan Jensen, she it's a real good one. So what is that we can prove, and Jensen can prove to us, say it's good for diabetes, number two. So like my wife, she had done, you know. But I don't know, it's depending on your blood and your body is to fit that kind, and I think it will be work. But some people, they say they try, it won't work, you know, depending on the people. But mostly, you know, what we use, I use for put my tea I drink every day in the morning. And also I use for like a slide. And when I drive my transportation, I feel drowsy. I can put it in my mouth and like a chew. So that it would be very good. And you go long distance driving, you know, like from here. I drive often from here to Oklahoma for 10 hours. So I just took the ginseng with me. And when I feel tired, so I can chew the ginseng in my mouth. So that can help me energy. So I feel ginseng, it's real good energy.
Do you think ginseng has a positive future?
Yeah, I think from now, I hope we depending overseas market, but it depending, and so we have like Canada, like Canadian grower more. We have some other like from South Korea, but we hope American will keep our demand, will keep our quality. I hope American, it will be remain the market for longer. Will compare for other, you know, because we never use any illegal drug, illegal chemical. We never have any free. We consider it a free residue, you know, free chemical residue. So that we consider it will be the top ginseng. What I heard, you know. Around the world, you know.
Well, that's incredible, and I am aware of our time, and so I would like to thank you for sharing your story and all of your wisdom with us. And just to restate again, it is October 12, 2013, and we are at the Ginseng Board of Wisconsin in office in Marathon, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You invite me to come.